This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio. Fashion.
So a really new, important book, a really important new book, I should say. It's a Friday afternoon, everyone. Landed on our desk, and we're so delighted to have the author with us. The book is called Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. And I don't say this lightly. We talk a lot about books. This is an important book. This is one that I feel like takes something that we're talking about so often. We're using, you know, with our kids, everyone around us, especially in a city like New York, and really makes you stop and think.
Let's bring in Dana Thomas. She's the author. The title of the book, Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about this, because I feel like we do look at the retail sector a lot. For a while, we were talking about how fast fashion was doing so well, how great that was for the consumer, so on and so forth. But there's a big downside to all of this.
There is a big downside. You know, we don't stop and think about, it's a bit like fast food, we don't stop and think about how our clothes are made. And when we do the deep think and the deep dive into it, you know, if it costs $19.99, chances are it was made for 19 cents, or the person who made it was paid 19 cents. I went to Bangladesh for the anniversary of Rana Plaza. I met the survivors who suffered terribly, some are bedridden. You know, they were sewing clothes that the day before that went to stores that we bought. We don't think about that. They earn $68 a month. You know, the owner of Zara is one of the richest men in the world. $68 billion is his wealth. And yet they pay people pennies to make the clothes upon which that wealth is built.
So you really dig into this throughout the course of this book. Briefly, how did we get to the point that essentially someone decided, or maybe we all decided, that this was okay? And I love the analogy you draw between fast food, because there is something very meaningful in that connection, because part of the reason that people eat fast food is because it's cheap.
It's cheap. And, you know, you're going out and you're having a good time. It's because, you know, things got so cheap post-NAFTA and offshore, that, you know, instead of paying union wages to people in the Carolinas and in Alabama and Mississippi to sew things, it was sent overseas. I was just in Florence, Alabama last week for Shindig, Billy Reid's event, and I was there to see Natalie Channon, who I profile in the book, both of them. It was the t-shirt capital of the country, of the world, for a long time. It's where all the Fruit of the Loom was made and things like that. And that all went offshore, and that town died a thousand deaths. And now the t-shirt capital of the world is in China, where they pay a lot less than they did in Florence. But now you have direct-to-consumer, you have people going back to Florence like Billy Reid and Natalie Channon, who are realizing they can run businesses from these small towns for lower overhead, employ folks, get some tax incentives like the reshoring and right-shoring in the Carolinas, bring the industry back, and it's coming back cleaner and better.
Bringing the consumer into this, because I remember a few years back, a journalist who made some comment about, was kind of critical of, like, are you ready to pay $100 for that t-shirt? Because if you really, you know, do it at the higher wage, labor cost.
What it's worth.
You know, exactly, what it's worth.
What it's
and
worth.
And I mean, Americans have gotten used to paying a lot of people have gotten used to paying nothing for items. Are we ready to kind of
dial it back?
Yeah.
Dial it back and fork out more?
Yeah.
Well, one of the most amazing moments I had working on this book, I was reading a piece from the New Yorker from 1940 where it was talking about Hattie Carnegie, the retailer of New York at the time. And she said that, you know, during the Depression, Hattie Carnegie, to shore up sales after her deep-pocketed clients lost all their money, came out with a line called Spectator Sport, and it retailed for $19.99. That's the same price as what you pay in fast fashion stores today, almost 100 years later.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The price of eggs and the price of ground beef have gone up 100 times since then, yet we're still paying the same for clothes. So are we paying cheaper because we can afford it, like fast food?
And buy more of it.
Or are we just paying so little that we can buy 10 of something right. instead of one, or 100 of something such instead
a,
of one.
Such a difference that I think of my European, you know, grandparents who had kind of what they needed, right? Versus we have homes full of stuff.
And that's why we burn through the clothes. The average garment is worn 7 times before it's tossed. In China, I hear it's 3 times because we don't cherish them anymore. We don't place value on them because we have invested in them.
Yeah. So do you see any optimism? Because I do think about my kids. I have 2 teenagers, and I actually think they think about this more. My 16-year-old son loves fashion. I mean, he really spends a lot of time thinking about what he wears, but he also thinks about where he's buying things.
Absolutely.
And he is willing to spend more of my money in order to buy things. But, you know, I think about a brand like Aviator Nation in California. You know, we were just out there and sort of shopping there. Their t-shirts are expensive, and you are paying a little bit for the brand, for sure. But there is this sense of quality. And to your point, there is this sense of, I'm going to take care of this because it costs more.
Well, I've been talking about this book this week. I remembered that I have a jacket in the closet. It's one of those fringe ones like Roger Daltrey wore in, you know, The Kids Are All Right. And I bought it when I was 16 with babysitting money. And I bought it, remember this, on layaway.
I know. Yeah.
Remember layaway?
Yes.
So it took me months. It took me 100 hours of babysitting at $1 an hour to buy that coat. And I went to the store several times to put down the cash. I invested in it. I still have it.
Yeah.
So we can vote with our pocketbooks. But I also do think I don't want to be high and mighty because we can maybe afford to do that. But not everybody in America can.
But we can bring back layaway. We can swap. We can buy secondhand. We are awash in clothes. That's why The Real Real is in a $1 billion valued business right now, selling secondhand clothes, or as a friend of mine calls it in the business, pre-loved.
Right.
Although, is it if it's been tossed so easily? Not so sure. Maybe we need to start thinking.
So Marie Kondo.
Marie Kondo cleaning out, right? So there are lots of options. But most importantly, it's okay to save and spend well on one thing rather than just, you know, absorbing.
That's how we grew up, munching through like Pac-Man.
Well, it's a great book, and we really enjoyed catching up with you. Congratulations on it, Fashionopolis.
Thank you so
much. Thought-provoking, interesting, and
what a great way to wrap up the week.
Action-oriented in the sense of it really gives us something to think about, as you say, going into the weekend.
So this week, our next guest reached out to me. I'm so glad that he did because he recently hosted a U.S. congressional delegation trip to China and Hong Kong. Here to tell us about it and give us some insights into the U.S.-China trade war, which we've been talking about certainly this week and really over the last month. Also some insight on those Hong Kong protests. Chris Fenton, he's trustee at the U.S. Asia Institute. He joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. Chris, nice to have you here. Tell us a little bit about this delegation, who went, what you did, and what insight you got from that happening.
Yeah, sure. Well, Carol, thanks for having me back on, and I really appreciate it. Yeah, we just literally got back from a 10-day trip over there. We, the U.S. Asia Institute, which I co-hosted this with, along with the Chinese People's Institute of Foreign Affairs, we were lucky enough to have Congressman Alan Lowenthal, Congresswoman Deena Titus, and Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick join us on this trip. It was the first time we've had House members over there in quite some time. I know Senator Daines has been over there for a quick trip, but we hit several different cities, Beijing and Hong Kong being two of the key ones, and then we swung through Macau, Chengdu, and Xi'an also.
What was the biggest surprise for you? You know so much about not just China, but sort of Asia in general, but more importantly, the relationships between the U.S. and China. What was the biggest takeaway, biggest surprise for you, Chris?
Well, the biggest takeaway I would probably say would be reiterating what we heard on the ground over there from various members of the side of their leadership. One of the quotes that I think was brought up in most meetings had to do with how rapidly the relationship between the two countries has deteriorated. It sort of has caught everybody off guard. And there's a real feeling that there's an inability to properly communicate that's going on at the moment. So there's a real push to try to get people-to-people exchanges going on, continue the efforts of the cultural diplomacy that's been going on between the two countries. In fact, bringing over another panda was another thing that was brought up. The film diplomacy and different collaborations on artistic endeavors, and obviously the commercial endeavors that have been going on bilaterally between the two countries have been so important. Really just keeping that glue together while the highest levels of government continue the negotiations.
We'll go a level deeper on the sort of artistic and especially the film side, because that's something obviously you know a lot about. You worked in that business for quite some time, very successful producer. I won't bore everybody with naming all the great movies you've been involved in, but Point Break, Looper, Iron Man 3, et cetera, et cetera. That has been a huge boon on both sides of this relationship. You know, that sort of intellectual property, there's been a lot of money made in that business. How much do you worry about that breaking down if we do, you know, enter this sort of like Cold War of sorts?
Well, look, if you go all the way back to the ping pong diplomacy moment of 1971, you realize that there's always a humanistic motivation to try to keep two sides talking, even during very tumultuous times. The film diplomacy is something that I came across back in 2011 when we worked together with U.S. Studios on the movie Looper, and then on a much bigger level between Disney, Marvel, and the China side on Iron Man 3. That film diplomacy sort of moment, I call it the Marvel and Mao effect, is something that allowed me to go back to Washington, D.C. and talk about it, and that led to me getting involved with the US-Asia Institute, because the Institute's really about people-to-people exchanges and finding common ground and continuing dialogue. And there's no better way to do that than through culture. And you see it, obviously, in sports. You see it in cultural arts, music, film, and even panda diplomacy, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, Seth, I just feel like, you know, we've had so many conversations, Chris, trying to make sense out of what's going on, what we need to know as investors. The markets have certainly moved on those headlines, either out of the United States, the president's tweets, or out of China. So what have we maybe misread about all of this that's been going on based on what you saw, what you heard firsthand?
Well, I think the misreading at times might be that the China side is turned off from continuing to talk. I think there's face issues that occur. There's different negotiating styles that obviously either work or don't. Our job is not to criticize what's going on at the highest level. It's more about making sure both sides continue to talk. And one thing that we heard, whether it was from the foreign ministry or from the standing committee or from the different municipal or provincial governments, is that there's a real willingness to continue to talk. They really feel like there's no one that wins in this unless the U.S. and China do it together.
Right.
So I think that's a really important part for the leaders of our country. And we had three great members of Congress over there to hear that. Mm-hmm. They come back to the States and they start to think about that and how they apply that to policy and legislation.
All right. Great to catch up with you. Looking forward to doing it again soon. Chris Fenton is a trustee with the U.S. Asia Institute. As we mentioned, very successful Hollywood producer, former agent. He's been around this. And this cultural diplomacy point, I think, is so important. We've talked with David Rubenstein before about panda diplomacy.
Right.
It all is very much wrapped up together. Great conversation with Chris.